The Dynamics of the City. His mother had been scared of cities. It had been part of his education. She had told him, "Cities are dangerous places. They're full of tough, scary guys." He was a tough boy himself, but he had walked around as a teenager, ready and willing to believe her, and he had seen that she was right. People on city streets were fearful and furtive and defensive. They kept their distance and crossed to the opposite sidewalk to avoid coming near him. They made it so obvious, he became convinced the scary guys were always right behind him at his shoulder. Then he suddenly realized, no, I'm the scary guy. They're scared of me. It was a revelation. He saw himself reflected in store windows and understood how it could happen. He had stopped growing at 15 when he was already 6'5" and 220 pounds, a giant. Like most teenagers in those days, he was dressed like a bum. The caution his mother had drummed into him was showing up in his face as a blank-eyed, impassive stare. They're scared of me. It amused him, and he smiled, and then people stayed even further away. From that point onward, he knew cities were just the same as every other place, and for every city person he needed to be scared of, there were 999 others a lot more scared of him. He used the knowledge like a tactic, and the calm confidence it put in his walk and his gaze redoubled the effect he had on people. The Dynamics of the City. 55 minutes into the hour, he moved out of the shadows and stood on the corner, leaning back against the brick wall of the restaurant building, still waiting. He could hear the opera, just a faint breath of sound coming through the glass next to him. The traffic thumped and banged through potholes on the street. There was a bar on the opposite corner with an extractor roaring and steam drifting outward through the neon glare. It was cold, and the people on the sidewalk were hurrying past with their faces ducked deep into scarves. He kept his hands in his pockets and leaned on one shoulder and watched the traffic flow coming toward him. The two guys came back right on time in a black Mercedes sedan. It parked a block away with one tire hard against the curb, and the lights went out and the two front doors opened in unison. The guys stepped out with their long coats flowing and reached back and opened the rear doors and pulled ball bats off the rear seat. They slipped the bats under their coats and slammed the doors and glanced around once and started moving. They had 10 yards of sidewalk, then the cross street, then 10 more yards. They moved easily, big, confident guys, moving easily, striding long. Reacher pushed off the wall and met them as they stepped up onto his curb. "In the alley, guys," he said. Up close they were impressive enough. As a pair, they certainly looked the part. They were young, some way short of 30. They were heavy, padded with that dense flesh which isn't quite pure muscle, but which works nearly as well. Wide necks, silk ties, shirts and suits which didn't come out of a catalog. The bats were upright under the left side of their coats, gripped around the meat of the wood with their left hands through their pocket linings. "Who the hell are you?" the right-hand guy said. Reacher glanced at him. The first guy to speak is the dominant half of any partnership, and in a one-on-two situation you put the dominant one down first. "The hell are you?" the guy said again. Reacher stepped to his left and turned a fraction, blocking the sidewalk, channeling them toward the alley.
"Business manager," he said. "You want to get paid? I'm the guy who can do it for you."
The guy paused, then he nodded.
"Okay, but screw the alley, we'll do it inside."
Reacher shook his head.
"Not logical, my friend. We're paying you to stay out of the restaurant starting from now, right?"
"You got the money?"
"Sure," Reacher said. $200.
He stepped in front of them and walked into the alley. Steam was drifting up to meet him from the kitchen vents. It smelled of Italian food. There was trash and grit underfoot, and the crunch of his steps echoed off the old brick. He stopped and turned and stood like an impatient man, bemused by their reluctance to follow him. They were silhouetted against the red glare of traffic waiting at the light behind them. They looked at him and looked at each other and stepped forward shoulder to shoulder, walked into the alley. They were happy enough, big, confident guys, bats under their coats, two on one. Reacher waited a beat and moved through the sharp diagonal division between the light and the shadow. Then he paused again, stepped back like he wanted them to precede him, like a courtesy. They shuffled forward, came close. He hit the right-hand guy in the side of the head with his elbow. Lots of good biological reasons for doing that. Generally speaking, the human skull is harder than the human hand. A hand-to-skull impact. The hand gets damaged first. The elbow is better, and the side of the head is better than the front or the back. The human brain can withstand front-to-back displacement maybe 10 times better than side-to-side displacement. Some kind of a complicated evolutionary reason. So it was the elbow and the side of the head. It was a short, hard blow, well delivered, but the guy stayed upright on rubber knees for a long second. Then he let the bat go. It slid down inside his coat and hit the ground end-on with a loud wooden clonk. Then Reacher hit him again. Same elbow, same side of the head, same snap. The guy went down like a trap door had opened up underneath his feet. The second guy was almost on the ball. He got his right hand on the bat handle, then his left. He got it clear of his coat and swung it ready, but he made the same mistake most people make. He swung it way too far back, and he swung it way too low. He went for a massive blow aimed at the middle of Reacher's body. Two things wrong with that. A big backswing takes time to get into, and a blow aimed at the middle of the body is too easy to defend against. Better to aim high at the head or low at the knees. The way to take a blow from a bat is to get near, and get near early. The force of the blow comes from the weight of the bat multiplied by the speed of the swing, a mathematical thing. Mass times velocity equals momentum. Nothing you can do about the mass of the bat. The bat is going to weigh exactly the same wherever the hell it is, so you need to kill the speed. You need to get close and take it as it comes off the backswing. While it's still in the first split second of acceleration, while it's still slow, that's why a big backswing is a bad idea. The further back you swing it, the later it is before you can get it moving forward again. The more time you give away. Reacher was a foot from it before the swing came in. He watched the arc and caught the bat in both hands, low down in front of his gut. A foot of swing, there's no power there at all, just a harmless smack in the palms. Then all the momentum the guy is trying to put into it becomes a weapon to use against him. Reacher swung with him and jacked the handle up and hurled the guy off balance, kicked out at his ankles and tore the bat free and jabbed him with it. The jab is the move to use, no backswing. The guy went down on his knees and butted his head into the restaurant wall. Reacher kicked him over on his back and squatted down and jammed the bat across his throat, with the handle trapped under his foot and his right hand leaning hard on the business end. He used his left hand to go into each pocket in turn. He came out with an automatic handgun, a thick wallet, and a mobile phone.
"Who are you from?" he asked.
"Mr. Petrosian,"
the guy gasped. The name meant nothing to Reacher. He had heard of a Soviet chess champion called Petrosian and a Nazi tank general of the same name, but neither of them were running protection rackets in New York City. He smiled incredulously.
"Petrosian," he said. "You have got to be kidding."
He put a lot of sneer in his voice, like out of all the whole spectrum of worrisome rivals his bosses could possibly think of, Petrosian was so far down the list he was just about totally invisible.
"You're kidding us, right?" he said. "Petrosian? What, is he crazy?"
The first guy was moving. His arms and legs were starting on a slow-motion scrabble for grip. Reacher crunched the bat for a second and then jerked it away from the second guy's neck and used it to tap the first guy on the top of the head. He had it back in place within a second and a half. The second guy started gagging under the force of the wood on his throat. The first guy was limp on the floor, not like in the movies. Three blows to the head, nobody keeps on fighting. Instead, they're sick and dizzy and nauseous for a week, barely able to stand.
"We've got a message for Petrosian," Reacher said softly.
"What's the message?"
the second guy gasped. Reacher smiled again.
"You are," he said.
He went into his pocket for the labels and the glue.
"Now lie real still," he said.
The guy lay real still. He moved his hand to feel his throat, but that was all. Reacher tore the backing strip off the label and eased a thick worm of glue onto the plastic and pressed the label hard on the guy's forehead. He ran his fingers side to side across it twice. The label read, "Mostros has got protection already."
"Lie still," he said again.
He took the bat with him and turned the other guy face upward with a hand in his hair, used plenty of glue, and smoothed the other label into place on his brow. This one read, "Don't start a turf war with us." He checked the pockets and came out with an identical haul, an automatic handgun, a wallet, and a telephone, plus a key for the bents. He waited until the guy started moving again. Then he glanced back at the second guy. He was crawling up to his hands and knees, picking at the label on his head.
"It won't come off," Reacher called. "Not without taking a bunch of skin with it. Go give our best regards to Mr. Petrosian and then go to the hospital."
He turned back, emptied the tube of glue into the first guy's palms, and crushed them together and counted to 10. Chemical handcuffs. He hauled the guy upright by his collar and held him while he relearned how to stand. Then he tossed the car key to the second guy.
"I guess you're the designated driver," he said. "Now beat it."
The guy just stood there, eyes jerking left and right. Reacher shook his head.
"Don't even think about it," he said, "or I'll rip your ears off and make you eat them. And don't come back here, either. Not ever. Or we'll send somebody a lot worse than me. Right now, I'm the best friend you got, okay? You clear on that?"
The guy stared, then he nodded cautiously.
"So beat it," Reacher said.
The guy with the glued hands had a problem moving. He was out of it. The other guy had a problem helping him. There was no free arm to hold. He puzzled over it for a second and then ducked down in front of him and came back up between the glued hands, piggybacking him. He staggered away and paused in the mouth of the alley, silhouetted against the glare of the street. He bent forward and jacked the weight onto his shoulders and turned out of sight. The handguns were M9 Berettas, military issue 9mm. Reacher had carried an identical gun for 13 long years. The serial number on an M9 is etched into the aluminum frame right underneath where Pietro Beretta is engraved on the slide. The numbers on both guns had been erased. Somebody had used a round-tipped file, rubbing from the muzzle toward the trigger guard, not a very elegant job of work. Both magazines were full of shiny copper parabellums. Reacher stripped the guns in the dark and pitched the barrels and the slides and the bullets into the dumpster outside the kitchen door. Then he laid the frames on the ground and scooped grit into the firing mechanisms and worked the triggers in and out until the grit jammed the mechanisms. Then he pitched them into the dumpster and smashed the phones with the bats and left the pieces where they lay. The wallets held cards and licenses and cash, maybe $300 in total. He rolled the cash into his pocket and kicked the wallets away into a corner. Then he straightened and turned and walked back to the sidewalk, smiling. Glanced up the street. No sign of the black Mercedes. It was gone. He walked back into the deserted restaurant. The orchestra was blazing away, and some tenor was winding up to a heroic high note. The owner was behind the bar, lost in thought. He looked up. The tenor hit the note, and the violins and cellos and basses swarmed in behind him. Reacher peeled a 10 from the stolen wad and dropped it on the bar.
"For the plate they broke," he said. "They had a change of heart."
The guy just looked at the 10 and said nothing. Reacher turned again and walked back out to the sidewalk. Across the street, he saw the couple from the restaurant. They were standing on the opposite sidewalk, watching him. The sandy guy with a mustache and the dark woman with the briefcase. They were standing there, muffled up in coats, watching him. He walked to his four-wheel drive and opened the door, climbed in and fired it up, glanced over his shoulder at the traffic stream. They were still watching him. He pulled out into the traffic and gunned the motor. A block away, he used the mirror and saw the dark woman with the briefcase stepping out to the curb, craning her head, watching him go. Then the neon wash closed over her, and she was lost to sight.